Mr. Vaughn, you were pretty good, too. Mr. Canna did introduce you as his co-counsel, so,
right.
You know, that compliment
yeah.
applies to you, too. All right. The fourth case, Butts versus Aurora Healthcare, 03-40-61. This is certainly a Milwaukee theme for today. Miss McNamara McGraw was an alder person in the city of Milwaukee for a number of years.
Indeed, and I am happy to be here. It feels like old home day, a little bit anyway. May it please the court, I am appearing today on behalf of Celestine O. Shackelford Butts in a matter that I imagine will not take up my full time because the argument is very straightforward. There are basically two issues. This matter was litigated almost entirely pro se by Ms. Butts, an African-American young woman who worked for Aurora Healthcare for several years. And during that time, she worked two jobs, and she gained one promotion from her entry-level job to a slightly less entry-level job in the IS Information Systems Department. She put herself through college. She was a military veteran. She had the usual, at least identifiable, difficulties that one sees time and time and time again in people who come from low economic means as well as being in a racial minority in a city like Milwaukee, which is has a dominant white majority employment force. Ms. Butts worked two jobs. As I mentioned, she got a degree with honors in IS, an AA degree, and she proceeded systematically to apply for higher level jobs. And ultimately, she was denied all of them, and she filed her claims in the usual way, I would say very specifically through the EEOC and the State Equal Rights Division. And when she got the right to sue, she ultimately filed a pro se complaint in federal court. It wasn't until very close to the end of the program, the scheduling order, that she in fact asked the magistrate judge whose jurisdiction she had consented to appoint counsel. And as the court well knows, the appointment of counsel is discretionary, and at that point, according to the record, at least as defendants have it, it was almost over with. The case was almost over with. And at that point, when the court did use its discretionary authority to appoint pro bono counsel, and pro bono counsel accepted, counsel then moved to do what would be considered the diligent thing and the competent thing, and in fact, what counsel may have considered was the thing the court may have been thinking about in granting her appointment, and that was she filed a motion to amend the complaint to reinstate under Section 1981 the very claims that by agreement the parties had agreed to drop while Ms. Butts was a pro se complainant.
Let me ask you, I don't know what the procedure is in the Eastern District now, but is there any requirement that a pro se litigant in a case such as this must sort of shop the case around before you can get the court to intervene and solicit a lawyer to represent you? I mean, this is the case you get attorney's fees if you have a good case and win and so on, and I know that there was a time when the judges required pro se litigants to come in and say, I talked to three or four different lawyers, here they are, none of them would take the case, and then the court would, if appropriate, see if they could get a lawyer to accept it on a pro bono basis. But what happened here?
Well, Your Honor, opposing counsel may know by experience. I don't know that I saw a record of that, but I would advise you that in this day and age, this practice is so difficult that I don't know of any competent counsel, even if Ms. Butts shopped it around, which I presume she did. I mean, I certainly knew in my dealings with her, saw her to be a very competent person who had done a lot of work, a lot of legwork, a lot of investigating on her own. She had a full record. But I can advise you that there isn't an attorney that I know in practice in this very, very difficult area of the law that would ever take a case on straight contingency like this. It's simply too risky. And there's nothing to be gained. So ultimately, I would think that the issue really came down to the discretion of the court. And
so lawyers don't take any of these cases on contingency?
No. Your Honor, they get dismissed as this. Another body may realize
more often. You walk into a lawyer's office and the lawyer thinks you've got a good case, they won't take it?
I don't know of any that can afford to do it right now, Your Honor.
You might be, I'm not questioning that. This seems surprising to me.
Times have changed. If I may.
Yeah, I just wanted to get into her prima facie case.
Yes.
If I could. I want to know how you're showing that the promotions were given to persons who were not better qualified than she, because when you look at the others, even though she met the posted qualifications, everyone else had basic systems experience or technical experience at Aurora.
Well, Judge, we simply don't take the self-serving affidavit for true. Defendants submitted not a scintilla, not a piece of documentary evidence proving their statements, and that's the second issue, and that is, at what point does articulation only, when a prima facie case has been established, which the court found it was, when does the prima facie case allow the defendant to simply articulate rather than produce? I mean, there is a burden of production, and if we've now have minimized the requirement for production down to just articulation, we're back to ending civil rights practice. Because if all it takes is for an employer to say, trust me, I didn't discriminate against even the evidence they agreed to, which is 12 candidates, the other 12 were all white, and one candidate, my client, who was the only one with a college degree. If we can accept that that she didn't have a right to a trial on the basis of, trust us, we didn't discriminate, then there's no more race cases that can ever be tried in the U.S. And that's the simple point, Your Honor.
And so affidavits of persons who have personal knowledge, you're saying, are not enough.
Exactly, Your Honor. This is a relatively little litigated area of the law as well. And I cited the cases that I think are most pointed on this area, the Dunn and the Szymanski case. And it's very... In this case, the only documentary evidence produced was Ms. Butts' evidence. The rest of it was all hearsay. Trust us, they had better qualifications. And I would just say by analogy, in St. Mary's Honor versus Hicks, the court concluded that if the defendant produces no evidence to support a non-discriminatory basis for acting, the presumption raised by the prima facie case, like any other legal presumption, stands unrebutted and entitles the plaintiff to judgment as a matter of law. That's when you have a trial. Here, the court found prima facie evidence, and then on the very issue of motive and intent, which is, trust us, it wasn't race, said, we believe the affiance, even though they didn't show anything. And we believe that that's so simply going to eliminate race discrimination cases from the dockets that we ask the court to reverse. Thank you.
Zimmerman?
And I acknowledge that I used up more than my 5 minutes. Thank
you. Good morning. I am Mary Pat Ninneman with Quarles & Brady, and I'm here today on behalf of Aurora Healthcare. I believe that there are four issues in this case. The first two deal with the judge's district court's decision to deny the motion to amend the complaint. As an initial matter...
On that one, if a pro se litigant is abandoned some claims, as she did here, but it seems to be that she was abandoning them because she was getting the feeling that they were not timely. And maybe they were timely. Should that weigh into the calculus of whether you should, when a lawyer gets in the case, allow those claims to be resurrected?
I do not think that that should weigh into the calculus. I don't think that that's consistent with, in fact, what happened in the case. Ms. Butts started her action in September of 01. She pleaded three causes of action that had to do with failures to promote to various positions. Two of her causes of action were part of an EEOC complaint that she had filed. The third cause of action was the second EEOC complaint that she had filed. At the Rule 16 conference, Judge Goodstein discussed with the parties what they saw as the issues. We raised as an issue the fact that the third cause of action, which was the second EEOC complaint, had not been, no action had been commenced within 90 days. We also had a different timeliness argument with respect to the first cause of action. What Ms. Butts decided to do at that scheduling conference was withdraw the two claims on which the EEOC had found no reasonable cause. What she said was, really the one that I want to pursue is the one where the EEOC found that I might have a case, which was her second cause of action for the data center support analyst position. So although I certainly had a position with respect to timeliness that I thought was a real winner, so that when we got to that point in the case, I thought we would succeed on that, I don't know that I was successful in convincing Ms. Butts that she had a timeliness problem, although she did admit that the third cause of action, she had not started it within 90 days of having received the right to sue. She did admit that at that hearing, and I don't know that that played into her decision to withdraw those claims, that third cause of action, but I don't know that I was convincing on the first cause of action and whether she bought that argument. But in fact, the reasonable cause finding was limited to her second cause of action, which was the one that she proceeded on. I think that her appeal, though, of the order denying the complaint, the motion to amend the complaint, should be denied on jurisdictional grounds. Federal Rules 3 and 4 of Appellate Procedure 3 and 4 require that a notice be filed within 30 days of the decision or order appealed, and that the notice of appeal specify the decision or order that's being appealed from. In this case, Ms. Butts very specifically appealed from the summary judgment decision dismissing her complaint. She did not notice an appeal of the December 2002 decision denying her motion to amend.
But we're given some leeway when an appellant timely files a notice when they don't comply fully with Rule 3. That doesn't automatically doom the appeal, does it?
I believe that, yes, the court does have leeway in liberally construing Rule 3, but the requirements of Rule 3, even with liberal construction, are jurisdictional, and a failure to meet those requirements, even liberally construed, results in a dismissal. It makes the appeal fatal. And in this case, as I said, Ms. Butts very specifically designated, she was required to designate by Rule 3C1, what she was appealing from, and what she was appealing from was the summary judgment decision. She did not include the decision denying the motion to amend. In any event, though, the motion to amend should have been denied because it really was without merit. Justice does not require that leave to amend be allowed. She unduly delayed in bringing this motion. She obviously knew the facts underlying the causes of action for more than 2 years before she brought the action. She gave no justification for her delay in moving to amend her complaint. Judge Goodstein urged her at the first Rule 16 conference to retain counsel, and she proceeded to prosecute the action herself. Her deposition was taken. The time for discovery passed. After that, the judge held a scheduling conference. We stated our intent to file a motion for summary judgment. The court ordered that we do so by the end of the month, which was September 30th of 2002. At that time, Ms. Butt said, well, I think now I'm going to retain counsel. I found somebody who will represent me. The judge said, have that person contact me, and we'll do what we need to do. It wasn't until September 27th, 3 days before we were to file our summary judgment motion, a month after discovery was closed, that plaintiff, in fact, had her attorney put in a notice of appearance. At that time, plaintiff asked to reinstate her claims. The judge denied that request but gave her additional time for discovery so that she could defend against Aurora Healthcare's motion for summary judgment. She did absolutely no discovery. Approximately 2 months go by, and she brings the motion to amend the complaint, again simply reasserting the causes of action that she had withdrawn and alleging a 1981 claim. That was denied. The judge explained that not only was there an undue delay in bringing this motion, but to grant the motion would now prejudice Aurora by requiring it to redo discovery at its expense, and the claim was denied. The only grounds that she gave for the amendment was that the claims weren't untimely under Section 1981. The fact that Ms. Butt chose to prosecute her action pro se for an entire year, despite the judge's encouragement that she not do that, isn't a justification for allowing her delayed motion to amend. With respect to the prima facie case, Aurora Healthcare clearly articulated the reasons for promoting the six individuals that it did promote to the position of data center control, data center support analyst. The plaintiff, Ms. Butt, and Aurora Healthcare both agree to the trial court's statement of the facts. At pages 4 to 6 of its decision, which is in the appendix, pages 5 through 7. Those facts that are undisputed are that the six people that Aurora hired for the position had basic computer operations experience and technical experience at Aurora in computer operations on Aurora's multiple systems. It is undisputed that Ms. Butts had no experience in those areas. Her experience at Aurora was limited to a basic computer user. In responding to the summary judgment motion, Ms. Butts offered no testimony to show that reason for promotion decisions was pretextual. What she did was she put in evidence that she had an associate degree in microcomputers. Her belief that qualified her for the position, and that Aurora should have given that qualification greater emphasis than it did. But Ms. Butts is not entitled to substitute her judgment for Aurora's any more than this court would do.
Thank you. 2 minutes.
Well, Judge, I'd ask you to put this in the more proper context. Counsel has mixed taken away the real issue, which is once a counsel is appointed by the discretion of the court, does the court have the discretion to then hamstring the counsel from exercising her diligent obligation under her lawyer's oath? I believe Your Honors would...
I don't think anybody questions that the judge would have had the discretion to reopen and permit the amendment. The question is, is it an appropriate exercise of discretion concerning how those other claims were given up and what had happened in discovery to get the case to that point?
Well, Your Honor, I would simply say that I don't believe it was reasonable in any respect to deny that amendment, given that the issue placed in the record was timeliness. And in fact, it's possible to have inferred that appointed counsel understood that and made that very logical motion.
Does the record tell us that the claim that she really insisted on proceeding on was the one where the EEOC had found some reasonable grounds to believe that there was merit in her claim and abandoned claims that the EEOC did not?
I believe the record, Your Honor, points out that the one she kept was the one that wasn't attacked for timeliness. And because it was timeliness as an issue, it was abundantly clear that those other cases could have been brought in, but it's also a question of weight and balance. I mean, once there's an attorney on board, should one have to look back to decisions that the pro se plaintiff made and not start anew when the court exercised its decision to grant permission? It would have been easier for all concerned if counsel had not been permitted to be appointed. No question that wouldn't have been an abuse of discretion, but once counsel was appointed, counsel's hands were hamstrung from doing what she needed to do in order to diligently, under the attorney's oath, diligently represent her client. Some clients might say it was malpractice to not do that. If I might just go to the issue of...
Your time is up.
Thank you.
If you want a minute, you can finish.
Thank you.
I'm so generous.
I'm sorry. Well, you are, Judge. And right before lunch, I'm sure people don't appreciate it much. But I will say just very briefly, the jurisdictional issue is a smokescreen. There's no jurisdictional issue. 1291 makes it clear that you have to have a final decision, and case law after case law, it's abundantly clear in the Seventh Circuit that there is no issue that any motion like the denial to amend is brought into the final decision of the court. I don't think it's an issue at all. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement. Next case.